grave. I went for a walk on a winter's day. I'd be saving more if I was in L.A. California dreaming on such a winter's day.
Welcome back. This is Background Briefing. I'm Jessica Levinson, filling in for Ian Masters, who's taking a rare and well-deserved vacation. Our second guest is Kathy Fung. She's the executive director of California Common Cause. Her work focuses on election and redistricting reforms, disclosure and transparency laws, campaign finance reforms, and voting rights. Ms. Fung was instrumental in the successful effort to pass initiatives which led to the creation of an independent redistricting commission to draw both state and congressional district lines. Ms. Fung, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jessica.
So you're the executive director of a good government watchdog, California Common Cause. Could you tell us a little bit about this organization and what its charge is?
Sure. It was formed in the 1970s, and it was really a call to action to citizens, regular folks around the country, to try to create an organization that would represent our voices in our halls of the Capitol in Washington, D.C., but also in Sacramento, to give presence to regular people's interests and to counterbalance what we were seeing at the time, which was a lot of special interest influence and a government that was not accountable to people and only accountable to large money interests as well as powerful players that had no accountability to voters or to the public.
Well, it seems like we're continuing to deal with those themes now in 2012. Could you tell us from the reform perspective, what are some of the biggest challenges that someone who's attempting to create political reform in California is facing right now?
You know, I think the biggest issue is just that across the board, there is a general distrust of government. And that, at the same time, I think that there is a desire by the public to have certain services from the public, from the government provided to us. And there's a real kind of disconnect. And I think one of the key things that Common Cause and California Common Cause have really been focused on is how do we rebuild government in a way that it's responsive, that it's accountable, that it's flexible when it needs to be, that it nurtures the best ideas that come out of our citizens, and at the same time is one that people feel a sense of trust in so that we can move forward to do to rebuild our state in our best image possible. I mean, there was a time when people would come to California because we had the best schools and, you know, living here, not just because of the weather, but the infrastructure and, you know, the housing and the transportation was really the best in the United States. And there's a question about how we can recapture that, if it ever existed, but how can we build that kind of a dream again? And that does mean creating a government that people feel reinvested in and a sense of trust in again.
Well, I want to pick up on those themes throughout our discussion, this issue of increasing public confidence and on the other side, this deep distrust that we're seeing of the government that we see on almost every level of the government. And I want to start by talking about redistricting. This was one of your biggest accomplishments, creating for the first time in the state's history an independent redistricting commission that drew the state and federal legislative lines. But I want to ask you, why are we better off, from your perspective, to have a group of unelected citizens to do the very important task of drawing these lines rather than our elected officials who we can hold accountable in the elections?
Right. I think it's important to dissect that question and ask whether or not the question's even correct in some of its assumptions. And in order to do that, you got to go back to how it used to be. In 2001, I was involved in the redistricting process through an organization, the Asian Pacific American Legal Center, and I was organizing communities around the state to look at maps to see where their neighborhoods and their communities were, and to really try to put together presentations to present to the state legislature how they'd like to see the districts be drawn, in particular to make sure that their communities were not cut into different pieces. And it was a four-month process. There were less than a dozen hearings all told between the Senate and the Assembly. And I think people, you know, coming out of that hearing process, many of them doing it for the very first time, felt excited. And it was only after the hearing process closed and the legislature stopped deliberating in public and went behind closed doors and drew the lines that they really wanted to over the next 2 weeks, that people realized the reality, which is that the hearings were a dog and pony show, and that the real lines that were going to be drawn would be done as horse trading of neighborhoods and areas in order to protect incumbents. And ultimately, the Democrats and the Republicans did a deal between themselves to ensure that every single incumbent would have a super safe seat and nobody would be dislodged. And what that meant was that if communities along the way had to be sliced and diced into multiple different districts, that was just a sacrificial lamb that people were willing to make because, you know, those votes don't matter anyways. And for the next decade, what we had was districts where the person who was the designated incumbent or the designated successor to that seat essentially had the district rigged for them to win through the rest of the decade. And there were literally only one out of, you know, hundreds of incumbents who ever saw their seat get successfully challenged. And parties didn't switch hands, people didn't have a choice. And I think that that really creates a disconnect between those who are elected and the people who are supposed to be in charge, which is the voters. And so when you say that, you know, have we switched to a system where instead of having electeds draw the lines and assume that electeds can actually be voted out of office if we don't like them, the problem with that assumption is that at least the way that we had it before, because they drew their own lines, they could never be voted out of office. We had some electeds who had been charged with crimes and investigated and literally on their way to, you know, a prison cell, and they could still be reelected because the lines had been drawn in such a way where all of the challengers had been removed from the district and they'd been loaded up with voters who were supportive of that particular incumbent. So we now have a situation where people are seeing already in 2012 a very different electoral landscape where there are actual choices, where there's competition between elected, sometimes between the same party, sometimes between different parties, and where the outcome is one where a voter's casting a ballot will actually make a difference. And that's where I think it's significant, because if we're going to revitalize our democracy, then your vote has to mean something. It can't be a rigged outcome from the beginning.
Well, it sounds like what you're describing is sort of an inherent conflict of interest with legislatures drawing their own district lines to allow themselves to safely be reelected, but not necessarily with an eye towards keeping communities of interest together. And you mentioned these issues of the importance of a right to vote that matters. And I want to talk about that also with respect to voter suppression laws and voter ID laws. And in this election, I think maybe more than ever, we saw a lot of proposals, voter identification laws, reductions in early voting, and challenges to those laws. And then we found that those laws were declared unconstitutional. And I know that you've worked in the voting rights arena for a long period of time, and I was wondering if you could walk us through what are the legal challenges to those voter ID laws and those laws that reduce early voting?
Right. So around the country, just in the course of 1 year, between 2010 and 2011, We went from two states having voter ID laws to a dozen states successfully introducing and most of those even passing voter ID laws, some of them very stringent. In some cases, you know, there were states like Texas where the kind of voter ID that was required was photo ID, and they would list certain kinds that were acceptable and certain kinds that weren't. And the ones that were acceptable included, for instance, gun permits, and then unacceptable might be a student ID, even if it was issued by the educational institution. And here we saw courts again and again look at the IDs that were required and ask, have we placed too great of a burden on the voter to securing these IDs, or have we created a discriminatory situation where some kind of ID is preferenced over another, where, you know, in function, we've got the same, we're not necessarily serving the same purpose, right? And in case after case, whether it was Texas or Pennsylvania or Ohio, the courts looked at the ID requirements and said these burdens are too heavy. The state hasn't shown that it's got a plan in place to ensure that everybody can get their ID in time that would be satisfactory, you know, to meet these requirements, and that we wouldn't be essentially disenfranchising people. The problem is that those laws are still on the books. And so it is possible that moving forward, if a state proposes a plan for how they're going to get some type of ID into everybody's hand, even if that ID costs a couple hundred dollars to get, or even if in order to get that ID you have to present, for instance, a birth certificate, which may in and of itself be an expensive or difficult proposition to meet, that those requirements haven't necessarily been struck from the books entirely. Now, around the country, we also saw a concerted effort to roll back other kinds of advances that had made voting much easier. Early voting is one of them. So in many states, the counties were allowed to offer early voting. In some cases, it was sort of 2 weeks before the election or even a month before the election, and people could go into a designated location and be able to receive a ballot and cast a ballot early. And the game that was going on there was it was very motivated by political interests. You know, the people who pushed these laws were politicians who were interested in manipulating the election outcomes. And so they looked to see which populations do I not really want to come out to vote, and how do I make sure that I change the laws in such a way that will impact on lowering that population's turnout. In Florida, the big battle was whether or not they would allow voting on the Saturday and Sunday leading up to elections. And the reason was because a lot of African-American churches had used that Sunday at the pulpit as a, you know, a big motivational sermon and then a time to get people to the polls. And it was thought that that had positively impacted, you know, in turnout on for one party versus another. And so the party in power decided, well, we're not going to have that. We're going to remove the Sunday voting. That happened throughout southern states and the East Coast, and some of those rollbacks were actually challenged. Again and again, there were these kinds of challenges to voting advances that had already been made, or new laws were put into place to create restrictions on voting and voter registration. And the courts almost unanimously pulled back on that, said, you know, you can reduce early voting, but you can't reduce it to the extent that you're going to impact on voter turnout. Or you can have some types of voter ID, but you need to provide provisions for everybody to be able to still be able to vote, even if they don't have the correct ID at hand. So you have to give them a fail-safe voting mechanism or something else.
So I want to stay on this theme that's so important of exercising your right to vote, the fundamental right to vote, fundamental because it preserves so many other rights.
Right.
And one of the things that you've done is your position as executive director of California Common Cause, And I know this because you nicely asked me to also volunteer, is to, on election day, work with a nonpartisan election protection group to field calls and protect people's right to vote by working a call center. Could you describe what some of the most common problems facing voters in California are today? What are some of the most common calls that you got?
Right. So probably over 50% of the calls that we get are people who are either not sure of where they should vote or they're not sure if they're registered to vote. And so a lot of the time it's not an egregious, you know, suppression of the vote that we're helping people through. It's just going online and helping them to look up their information and figuring out, okay, so here's your poll site, and yes, in fact, you are registered to vote, and here's how you need to follow through on that. In some cases, there were people who would call who thought they had registered to vote, but they had showed up to a poll site, and in fact, their name was not in the roster. In which case, what we did was we encouraged them to vote provisionally, because in California, we do have fail-safe voting, and 87 to 90% of all provisional votes do get counted. So that's a good thing. Some of the other problems that we saw around California were much more troubling. Some of them included a real rise in poll workers taking it upon themselves to ask voters for ID. Now, we don't know if that is coming from confusion because they heard about it in the news happening in other states, and they somehow transplanted all of that voter ID talk to California, or if these might have been people who had been recruited by this vigilante group called Election Integrity Project to infiltrate into the poll worker volunteer roles and essentially exercise the law, you know, in the way that they saw fit. In some cases, these poll workers would ask everybody for ID. In some cases, they would only ask Latino voters for ID. In either case, as soon as we found out about it through our hotlines or from our poll monitors, we would immediately call the county and have them intervene and correct the situation. But it happened often enough that it was a very troubling pattern. And I think that that's probably the biggest concern that we need to just look out for is this kind of insidious perversion of what the law should be in California to ensure that every voter who shows up actually has the ability to cast a ballot and is not turned away just because of either ignorance or because somebody has taken it upon themselves to pervert the law.
Well, I'd love to talk more about this topic, but I want to wrap up in our remaining about minute and a half with the very important topic that relates to everything we've discussed, which is civic engagement and allowing people of whatever partisan stripe to participate in our representative democracy. And I was wondering, now in our remaining minute, what are some of the steps that you at Common Cause are taking to try and increase public participation in our government?
Well, we're pushing for a lot of laws that I think remove barriers. So some of those examples include the recent passage of the online voter registration law, which immediately allowed 1 million voters to be able to access the system, register to vote, and get engaged. And, you know, a lot of times it's simple things like that. You know, if somebody thinks, hey, I want to get involved, but where do I find that voter registration form? And if they have to go around to the libraries or post offices and hunt it down, that creates the bump in the road that may be the reason why they end up not voting ultimately. If they can go online and it's easy because that's how we now do so many other transactions, then why not? And particularly if it's just a matter of getting one system to talk to another, then it's something that also happens to save the state money. Another big change that we're pushing for is same-day registration. And here's where, you know, the kinds of calls that we got in in election protection hotlines where people were calling and saying, I know I registered, but I'm just not, you know, they're not finding my name in the roster. That kind of problem could be cured with same-day registration, where if you're eligible to vote and you show up to a designated site, you can still cast a ballot and just register on the spot. The only reason why we have registration deadlines that are 2 weeks in advance is because a long time ago, it took time for us to not only process that information, but literally to carry those the forms.
Physically carry them.
Physically carry them to the sites, right? I mean, I don't want to say horse and buggy, but, you know, it was a long transport period and a long data entry period, and so all of those things took time. We're now in a situation where things can happen much more virtually, and so same-day registration is something where California, you know, really ought to be a leader, not a follower. The lastly is really a challenge to not just removing barriers, but how do we make our elections more vital and interesting to voters? And that means in making and supporting electoral changes that give people choices, so that when you are going to the ballot or even before then, candidates have an incentive to talk to you, and you have an incentive to vote because there's actual choices. And that's where campaign finance changes would remove the imbalance between big money and regular voters are big changes that we're supporting.
Well, Ms. Funk, thank you so much for joining us. We did get to talk in some depth about a number of political reform topics. I wish that we could have talked more about a cause close to my heart, campaign finance reform, but I again want to thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and what you're working on as Executive Director of California Common Cause. It was a pleasure to have you.
Thanks so much for having me, Jessica.
So we're going to take a brief station break, and then we'll be back with our last guest, Tori Van Oot of the Sacramento Bee.